From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Election Day 2018, it's 18 months away. We've got political news for you, including the fact that Governor Snyder gets to appoint two more justices.
Michigan has seven Supreme Court justices, and after all is said and done, Snyder will have appointed four justices.
A national conservative group is now raiding state legislators.
Much of the action to advance conservative principles was shifting to the states.
We'll hear about some of Michigan's prison history.
You had the cheap labor of prisoners, and your town was guaranteed to become a thriving industrial town.
And we'll talk about getting mental health help for people who get cancer. Plus, with this cold snap, how's that apple crop? We'll find out, but first, a big, crisp bite of the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Well, a bit of political news dropped last night. Congressman Dan Kildee, who many expected to run for governor, said he's not going to. He's going to run for another term in Congress. To talk about that are Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark, our It's Just Politics team. So first thoughts about Kildee not running for governor.
Not really a surprise that even though at this time last year he certainly seemed to be, in part because he was, doing everything to prepare for a race, but we've been hearing in recent weeks that he was cooling to the idea for a whole bunch of reasons and will probably opt to run for re-election to his congressional seat.
Indeed. I mean, I think there was this idea that he was, you know, if he was going to run, we would have known February, then March, then April. We're now in the beginning of May, so I don't think people are shocked. And really what we're hearing is that actually last week's health care vote in the House of Representatives really made him realize that he still feels like he's wants to fight in D.C. and that there's some big issues happening in the federal government, and he wants to be a part of that.
As it is right now, among Democrats, we have former Senate Minority Leader Gretchen Whitmer, former Detroit Health Director Abdul Al-Sayed. Anybody else thinking about throwing their hat in the ring for the Democrats?
Well, there are four other names in the race, but those are the ones who really seem to be getting their names out there and are out there working the working the circuit. But now that Dan Kildee is out, we are hearing that there is another well-known name who is interested, and that is Mark Bernstein of the Bernstein Law Firm family, which means that he would bring a lot of name ID, certainly money, and a strong network within the Democratic coalition. He's a very popular person inside the Democratic Party.
But how political is this? I love this, that just today, so, you know, we've got Republican Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly sort of talking about whether or not he's going to, he's kind of pushing this big announcement that he's going to make on May 30th. I think we all sort of assume he's going to throw his hat in. But
the classic announcing he's going to announce.
Right. So he's got this new video out that actually includes, though, Mark Bernstein's brother, Richard Bernstein, in the video, because he's a Supreme Court justice here in Michigan, and it's the two of them working together on some issues. So then the justice was asked, you know, yesterday, well, wait, are you supporting, you know, Brian Kelly? Now there's this, you know, his brother coming out on the Democratic side. So, you know, very Michigan politics here.
Awkward. So we also should mention among the Republicans who might be throwing their hat in the ring is Attorney General Bill Schuette. Speaking of the race for governor, Rick Snyder has a couple of state Supreme Court appointments to make. Tell us who is out and why.
Well, Bob Young, the senior member of the court and the former chief justice, retired, and he is considering a run for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate to run against the incumbent Democrat, Debbie Stabenow. And now Joan Larson has been named by President Trump to serve on the Sixth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. You might remember that she was on his shortlist for a potential Supreme Court nominee.
As was Bob Young.
Mm-hmm. Now, his seat was going to be up next year anyway, and so it doesn't change that, but that does mean that we're going to have two new names on the court. The governor is announcing, probably right as this is airing, that appeals court judge Curtis Wilder will fill the Young seat. The Larson seat will not be vacant until she's confirmed by the Senate, so, you know, we'll be waiting to see who he names to fill that vacancy, and then both of those nominees will have to run on the ballot next year.
But what what is absolutely fascinating about this, Lester, and this dynamic is Michigan has 7 Supreme Court justices. And after all is said and done, if Snyder does go ahead and appoint 2 new justices, Snyder will have appointed 4 justices, many, you know, some of whom will have, you know, run for re-election and re-won. But 4, that is a majority of the Supreme Court, of the judicial branch, you know, originally being appointed by the executive branch.
This can actually be called the Snyder Court at that point. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's just fascinating.
It is. So do we know who might be on Governor Snyder's shortlist if Larson is confirmed?
No, not for sure. They're still putting that together, although I would think that at or near the top of that list would be appeals court judge Mike Godola, that he served as Snyder's in-house attorney before being named to the court. And since, you know, Snyder appointed him to the Court of Appeals, obviously he's a fan.
That's Rick Pluta, Lansing bureau chief, and Zoe Clark, our resident political junkie. They host It's Just Politics, which you can find at michiganradio.org or listen on Mondays during Morning Edition. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thanks, Lester.
You bet.
In Michigan, the news report Inside Michigan Politics ranks the most conservative and the most liberal members of the state legislators. Among conservatives, being the most conservative is branding. It's going to be on campaign literature. Well, for the second year, there's another ranking for most conservative legislators in Michigan. The rankings are put out by the national group American Conservative Union. Larry Hart is a senior fellow at the ACU, and he joins us now. You've been ranking conservatives in Congress for a long time, but why are you now doing state legislators?
Well, that's true. We started rating members of Congress way back in 1971 and have been doing so every year. And in 2011, as gridlock gripped Washington, we realized that much of the action to advance conservative principles was shifting to the states. And we thought we would bring the same principles that we have in rating Congress to the states. We started with a pilot project of 5 states in 2011, and we completed all 50 states for the first time in 2015.
Now, I know that big donors such as the Koch brothers have been looking at state legislatures as well. Is this intended to be a guide for some of the big moneyed interest in the conservative movement to see the state legislatures for what they are?
Just the opposite. It's to guide our members and for conservative activists, grassroots activists across the country, and actually anyone that's interested in their state government, to get an idea of who the people are within the legislatures that represent conservative values.
Tell me a little bit about the history of the American Conservative Union so we know who you are. I understand that William F. Buckley was involved in founding ACU.
That's right. It was way back in 1964, following a conservative defeat of the Barry Goldwater's candidacy for president. Some of the founders of the modern American conservative movement, including William F. Buckley, Jr., got together to form the American Conservative Union. We call ourselves the nation's original conservative organization. And the idea is to serve as an umbrella group for different groups. We don't just look at one set of issues, economic or social or national security. We look at them all. And that has been true all throughout these years.
So with that said, let's take a look at the Michigan rankings. In the state Senate, no one reached 90%, meaning there was not an award for conservative excellence in the Senate. Sounds like that's a high bar.
Well, that's why we call it an award for conservative excellence. 7 members of the House in Michigan did reach that level in 2016.
Right. I'm going to read those off real quickly so people know. Todd Barrett, Lee Chatfield, Tristan Cole, Gary Glenn, Tom Hooker, Jim Runstad, and Lana Thies. How do you determine their conservative credentials?
Well, again, we look at issues, all types of issues that are of interest to conservatives, whether they be economic or social. And, of course, it somewhat depends on what, in a given legislative session, the type of votes that are taken. We don't require folks to be at the very top level to be recognized as true conservatives. We use a measure of 80% or above. 3 members of the Senate did reach that level in 2016. We go back to what Ronald Reagan once said, which is that if someone agrees with me 80% of the time, then I want to be with them. That's the standard we use. But as I say, it really depends upon the votes that are taken in any given session, and they can vary from year to year.
I noticed you listed no one as a member of the Coalition of the Radical Left, and I'm guessing there are a couple of people who are probably disappointed they didn't make that list. What kind of score do you have to earn radical left status?
That is a score of less than 10% out of 100.
I'm wondering, how does Michigan's legislature compare to other state legislatures?
They are somewhat in the middle of the pack.
So it's a mixed bag.
It is.
How do you think rankings like this affect the already substantial polarization of right and left?
I don't think that it really affects that so much, because when you go back to, for example, the congressional ratings that the American Conservative Union did for so many years, going way back, ACU rated some Democrats very highly, often got higher rankings than some Republicans did.
I'm guessing a lot of those were Southern Democrats who later became Republicans.
Many of them were. But that was reflected, and it wasn't the rankings that changed the
right,
that changed the partisanship. It was the political complexion, what happened in the country. So I don't think that telling people how their legislators are voting as far as conservative values are concerned really contributes to the polarization.
I only have one more question for you. Are you getting any feedback from the legislators when they find out that they're awarded one of these awards for being conservative?
Yes, we get a very good reaction from them because we send out certificates giving them that standing. They look upon it favorably. We've been out to Michigan a few times since 2011. 2 or 3 dozen members of the legislature have come to be recognized to get their awards in any given year. So it's gone over pretty well. We often complain about what people are doing if we don't like what they're doing. And it's very important to let those people know who are upholding conservative values that there's somebody out there that does give them a lot of credit for that.
Larry Hart is a senior fellow at American Conservative Union. The ACU just released its ratings of Michigan legislators. You can find out how the group ranked all the legislators and the bills on which they base those ratings at their website. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Coming up, we'll take a tour of Michigan's oldest prison with a historian who lives there.
My feeling is this history is utterly fascinating. It's such a part of Jackson, of Michigan, and of humanity.
And then in 20 minutes, we'll discuss the cold spring weather and an orchard grower.
People do lose sleep over this, whether they're up all night burning the brush piles and keeping the fans going, or whether they're just concerned they don't have any form of protection.
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Let's get out of the studio and go get locked up.
What are we going to do? Road trip.
We are in Jackson right now, and we're at Michigan's very first penitentiary. We're talking with the author of the book, Jacktown, History and Hard Times of Michigan's First State Prison by Judy Gale Krasno. Tell me about the beginnings of this prison, because it was the first and probably not the massive stone walls that we see now.
The first prison, after Jackson won the battle to have Michigan's first state prison, was a wooden fort. It was the Wild West. And they thought, well, forts protect people, so we'll build a fort. Unfortunately, they found out the hard way that that wasn't the case with prison, because in 1840, 10 very vicious inmates escaped to become the Jackson Robber Gang, and they had no competition, so they ruled the roost. They robbed coaches, they robbed cattle, they robbed horses, they robbed people, they killed, you name it, they did it. So Jackson and the state decided we had better build a brick and stone and mortar and iron prison, and they did.
So let's talk about Jackson and how hard it fought to get a prison because of a commodity.
Yes, the commodity was the cheap labor in the Industrial Revolution. If you had a penitentiary and you had factories, you had the cheap labor of prisoners, and your town was guaranteed to become a thriving industrial town.
Now, the prisoners were paid 33.5 cents per day, but where did most of that money go?
Most of the money went to the state. 28 cents of it, as a matter of fact. 5.5 cents went to the poor prisoner, and 28 to the state. So it was a win-win situation.
And at the time, wages were about $1.50 a day. They were actually earning 5.5 cents a day.
That's right. I mean, if you were a non-convict factory worker, depending on your skills, it was $1.50 to even $2.50 a day. But compare that to 5.5 cents. So part of the punishment, so they called it, and part of it was rehabilitation. They would come out with skills, but as my book states later on, those skills, because of the 1909 law saying you couldn't have a factory on the prison that was also in the town, in other words, prison couldn't compete with private, so they would gain skills and get out and not have the skills needed for the factories outside.
The prison cells were tiny. If you can imagine spending much of your day in a 5.5 by 4.5 foot space. People were not as tall then, but some of them were. Imagine not being able to fully stretch out as you slept. And the idea of pacing in your cell, ludicrous.
I mean, this was totally claustrophobic. There was no ventilation in this room, which was the original stone brick and mortar west wing. And that's what they had to spend their time in.
The stench of the place was unimaginable. There were no toilets. Prisoners used a chamber pot, a bucket. They called them honey buckets. They were dumped once a day. As we toured the prison, it's a little hard to imagine the row after row of small cells that were here. They've been removed. But there are some photos of the bad old days. The imposing stone walls surrounding the prison are still mostly there. The Michigan State Prison was not just a place to hold prisoners, it was a place to use the cheap labor.
You will be meeting.
There were a number of industries within the prison itself, the penitentiary itself, as well as down what is called Mechanics Street. So how many actually worked in here and how many were sent out to work under the auspices of private industry?
I would say maybe a quarter were out and three quarters were in. And the variety of factories from binder twine to the world famous Jackson Wagon Factory that built a wagon to carry Jumbo the elephant from the Barnum and Bailey Circus, a 13,000-pound elephant. You can imagine the expertise of the wagon builders to build a wagon that could carry that load, and that was the inmates of MSP.
This penitentiary started out, as we said, a wooden fort. Because Michigan was growing so fast, the number of people in prison grew so fast, there had to be constant additions. So how fast did this place grow?
The West Wing was started after the fort disaster, and that was in 1842. It was fairly well completed by 1848, though they added two more tiers. But then, as soon as it was completed, it got overcrowded, and they added the West End Wing, where I now live. And it wasn't long until that became overcrowded. So we're talking basically over a period of 40 years till the entire thing by 1882, with the East Wing, the East End Wing, the magnificent administration building, and all the factories. So it was a gradual process, but it's a fortress. I mean, they don't build buildings like this anymore.
As the prison continued to grow and grow, just how big did it get?
By the time this closed, actually before, as I said, by 1882, it was the largest walled prison in the world. That meant acreage and numbers of prisoners. Having, by the way, been condemned in 1914, but it took all that long to build the State Prison of Southern Michigan, in the East End Wing, they had to double them up like a dormitory room, and it was supposed to be for 6, and it ended up being for 12. And they still didn't have flush toilets. It was still the honey buckets, even then. But, of course, it was beautiful from the outside with coiffed gardens on the front of it, and the inside was horrendous. Between the honey buckets and the stench and being bathed twice a month, put in a bucket with cold well water, not allowed to wear underwear was part of the humiliation, and their uniforms were washed supposedly twice a month. So there were, you know, diseases and stench and lack of ventilation, and perhaps the worst thing, because we people talk, was the code of silence. That became a federal law in the big houses around the nation. You could not talk unless an authority engaged you in a conversation. And as soon as that was done, you were to be silent.
So no talking between the prisoners, no talking if a prisoner needed something. They couldn't ask.
They had to, for example, in a factory, if they ran out of leather or whatever the items were, they had to raise their hand. And depending upon the foreman, there were some that were a little more lenient than others. If you said, "Sir, I'm losing time, I have a quota," and spoke out like that, you could end up with bad time and in solitary, or wearing the iron cap, this heavy, heavy, literal medieval torture. And it ruined the collarbone. You could not remove it for a minimum of 14 days. You had to eat and sleep with it on. And there were other horrendous punishments for breaking the code of silence. Your hands, your wrists, were chained together, and a hook was put under the chain, and you were hoisted up with your feet 4 to 6 inches off the ground and left hanging that way for anywhere from 5 hours to 72 hours. And by the time you were taken down, your rotocuffs, your shoulders, your collarbone, you name it, you had no sensation left in your arms. So a lot of the inmates, most of whom were whipped, punished, they went out maimed. And they were supposed to live a normal life and get work and, you know, scars all over their bodies. It was horrendous. It was medieval, there is no doubt.
For most of its statehood, Michigan has not had a death penalty. Instead, those who were sentenced to life in prison for murder spent their time in solitary. That was in the basement. No light. No ventilation. At one point, state inspectors visited to see how the prisoners, including those serving a life sentence in solitary, were doing.
When the inspector found them, he was so horrified that their nails had grown like claws if they hadn't chewed them off. The hair was matted. They were crawling with bugs and, you know, vermin. And 9 of them could just grunt and had to be sent to the mental institution. And 6 of them carried out to the infirmary in the sun like brine shrimp from the Great Salt Lake exposed to sunlight died. And that was the result of something that we can say was so humane. 1846, Michigan was the first state ever to abolish capital punishment, but the punishment was then life in solitary, which is 20 of them, sentenced to that. 15 years later was when the inspectors came and found them malnutrition. I mean, just... So they went to the state legislature and said, reinstate capital punishment. The legislature did not. They said, instead, you wouldn't be condemned to life in solitary, but life in prison. And the term lifer originated right here at Michigan's first state prison.
This kind of behavior, this kind of treatment went on for decades, but finally, before this prison closed in 1934, there were some changes.
There were definite changes. They began actually in 1870 with John H. Purvis. He was the first reformer, and he said you have to be firm but compassionate. And then came Warden Hatch, who started educational programs saying if a man goes out educated, he'll have a better chance not to return. But the most amazing one was 1933, the very last chaplain at MSP, Albert M. Ewart. He believed that the arts were rehabilitative, and he formed a studio. He was a jack of all arts, and he taught painting and writing and whatever, art music composition. And in my book, Harry Evans, alias in the prison, John Blood, became a poet. He had a 15-year sentence for grand larceny. He got out after 7 and never returned. And I firmly believe it's because he found this marvelous form of expression within himself. And one of his very powerful poems is in my book, Jacktown.
After the prison closed, after the penitentiary closed in 1934, it was used by the military as an armory for a long time. But that's not what it is today. Tell me about what the Michigan State Prison Penitentiary is today.
It is the only old penitentiary repurposed into a residence and, to boot, an artist's residence community. And as walking through here, you can see the bars are still on the windows, but next to them hangs art, the art of the artists here at Armory Arts Village.
And you actually live here.
I live here, and I love my apartment. I chose it when the renovation was first beginning, and it was some 36 prison cells. I had no idea what my apartment would look like. And when I moved in here from Miami, Florida, thanks to WDET Detroit and its report about this that I heard in Miami, Florida, and brought me here, I came on January 5th, 2008, in the midst of a blizzard, shook and thought, oh my God, what have I done? And when I finally, shaking, got the key into the door and opened it, I was astounded at the magnificent job it was the Quinn Group, the architects, had done, still retaining the integrity of the building, the brick, the concrete, the bars on the windows, but really making unique apartments.
What's the lesson to be learned from Michigan's first state penitentiary?
The lessons to be learned, in my opinion, are that it was very medieval and punishment was considered a means of deterring others from committing crime, and the punishments were physical. I don't think we've really come all that far. Today, there aren't whippings and such, but there's more psychological damage done, and we still think that punishment will deter crime, but statistics don't prove it. My feeling is this history is utterly fascinating. It's such a part of Jackson, of Michigan, and of humanity. Because it is, you know, like what was going on then. But I also think there are lessons to be learned about thinking about what are we doing today with those who are incarcerated? And how can we truly have a person come out of prison truly rehabilitated and ready to live in normal society again?
The book is Jacktown, History and Hard Times at Michigan's First State Prison by Judy Gail Krasnow. Hey, one more thing. We've got some photos of the prison from today and from the past. You can find them online at michiganradio.org. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, we'll talk about the mental strain of a cancer diagnosis.
You're in a black hole. Nothing's pleasurable. You want to sleep all the time. You have a feeling that you're never going to get out and that there is no successful treatment or anything you can do to help yourself.
That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. You might have noticed we've had some really chilly mornings lately. There was frost on my car this morning. That made us think of the fruit crops in Michigan. We found this video of an orchard grower trying to keep his crop safe.
During the spring, we use a giant frost fan which blows warm air back down into the orchard on cold mornings to keep the apple blossoms from freezing.
That was Steve Tennis with the Country Mill in Charlotte, and he joins us now. Hey, Steve, what kind of crops do you grow there?
At the Country Mill Orchard, we grow apples, peaches, blueberries, sweet cherries. For our fruit crops, we also grow pumpkins and sweet corn as well.
What's most at risk at this time of year?
Right now, actually, the peaches and sweet cherries are at the most risk. Apples and blueberries are also always at risk as well.
I wanted to ask you more about that video. That frost fan sounded like a helicopter. What are other methods that orchard growers use when the weather turns a little chilly or frost comes?
That's an excellent question. The frost fans have become the most reliable form of frost protection across the United States, really across the globe for frost protection. But we can also do other things, which you couldn't hear in the video, as we burn small brush piles throughout the orchard to create extra heat that rises up to 40 to 60 feet where there's warm air, and that frost fan brings that warm air back down into the orchard.
I also understand that some people use misting or they use herbicide just for part of the grass so that the soil keeps more warmth. Is that something you've ever tried or you know of people using?
Yes, we do keep what we call like a sod strip underneath the trees as well. You can do that a couple of different ways. Herbicide, you can also use some tillage method. Part of our orchard is certified organic, and you can till up the ground underneath the trees in the days prior to a frost so that that bare soil absorbs the radiant heat from the sun. It maintains that heat, and then it releases that heat throughout the night when the temperature gets cold. That'll help you a degree or two. So there's different things you can do. The water system, we actually work with Michigan State University here at the Country Mill on a new project where we've misted these trees ever since March, some of our trees. And what we've done is we've tricked the trees to staying asleep, more dormant, so that they're not in bloom during days like this.
Wow, that's interesting.
An early freeze in early May. And so what that does is protect the trees a different way as well. So there's a lot of different things that apple growers are doing here in Michigan to help protect and ensure that we have a safe, affordable crop for you to harvest come this fall.
You know, my first thought was about the orchards up north, maybe Leelanau County by Traverse City or someplace like that. But I read a report that Southwest Michigan is actually more at risk because of the advanced state of the blooms. I guess everyone's losing sleep over this across the state. What are you hearing from your fellow growers?
That is correct. People do lose sleep over this, whether they're up all night burning the brush piles and keeping the fans going or whether they're just concerned they don't have any form of protection. Right now, it's still too early to see and tell how much damage there is, but there is going to be some damage and some reduction of the crop potential from where we would be. But for those of us growers that have invested the time and the resources into things such as these frost fans and other methods, we're confident we're going to have a good crop for Michigan consumers this fall to come on out to the orchard and pick apples fresh off the tree. What we may not have as many apples as we would like that we can sell outside of the state of Michigan. But that, again, remains to be seen. In the next couple of weeks, we'll be able to better estimate what the crop potential is here in Michigan.
That's Steve Tennis with the Country Mill in Charlotte. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, this has got to be one of the scariest things a person can hear. You have cancer. And maybe you've heard that in your life or in the life of a close friend or relative. If you've not, you can imagine the anxiety and the other likely psychological issues to accompany that cancer diagnosis and all that goes with it. There is a subspecialty of oncology called psycho-oncology, and here to talk about how that works are Michelle Reba, Associate Director of the University of Michigan Depression Center, and Bill Howe, who is a cancer survivor and found psycho-oncology treatment helpful. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting us.
Dr. Reba, I read that this idea originated as far back as the mid-1970s, but it wasn't fully embraced for a while. If a cancer patient was struggling back then, what did healthcare professionals do before psycho-oncology?
Well, it was very difficult. A lot of doctors, physicians, oncologists didn't necessarily ask about psychiatric issues, and patients and families didn't understand that they could ask and then get treatment for it. And so the subspecialty grew to what it is today.
So tell me how it works today then.
Well, I can tell you what it works at our cancer center, the University of Michigan Comprehensive Cancer Center, where we have an embedded psychiatric clinic right at the cancer center, and all patients who receive their care at our cancer center are entitled to be evaluated and treated, and it's just a wonderful opportunity and an ease of access for our patients and practitioners.
Is there automatic screening for everyone who gets a diagnosis of cancer?
Yes. The American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer and the National Comprehensive Cancer Network have developed guidelines for patients in the United States. And at our cancer center, we regularly screen for distress. And then based on that information and those guidelines, then patients are triaged further.
Mr. Howe, I'd like you to tell me, if you would, when did you learn you had cancer? Can you tell me about that time?
Certainly. I got the diagnosis of when I had a PA sample taken by my general practitioner.
Which, if you're a guy, you know that's your prostate measurement.
Yes, yeah. And it's a very good test. And I was about 55 years of age, and the PSA was very high. And subsequently, I had surgery, and the unfortunate part of it was the surgery didn't get all the cancer. It was outside the prostate. And so that became the major issue for me.
Now, that becomes the scarier part because a lot of guys are walking around with prostate cancer, but not outside, not once it's left. So was that the point it really hit you? Or?
Yes, I think it becomes overwhelming because I think you start to think about, first of all, this is it. Am I going to continue my life or am I not? And then you start asking yourself the questions about, what about my family? You know,
That's something I want to get to a little further. I want to talk about that because, I can't imagine you're thinking about what's going to become of my kids, my wife. Are they going to be okay and all those things? But I want to get back to how this felt to you. I mean, what was your gut feeling when you found this out?
My initial feeling was extreme anxiety. Being diagnosed with cancer, you start asking yourself a lot of questions, and there are a lot of questions but very few answers.
Did the depression start slipping in suddenly, or did it just build up over time? Tell me about how you experienced that.
Well, I believe that initially you have, or I had, extreme anxiety, and then you morph into a major depression disorder in my case. And it was during the treatment where I received, after surgery, I received chemotherapy, radiation, and hormone therapy. And it was during that time that it just became so apparent that I was in serious trouble.
Mm-hmm. So for somebody who's never had depression, how would you describe it?
I would describe it as a situation where the first thing you ask yourself is, why me? The second thing you say to yourself, what is this going to mean? But from a realistic or kind of a simply stated point of view, it's you're in a black hole. Nothing's pleasurable. You want to sleep all the time. You have a feeling that you're never going to get out and that there is no successful treatment or anything you can do to help yourself.
Tell me, how soon, where did you get help?
Well, I was fortunate enough. I had my surgery not at the cancer center, but my follow-up care was at the University of Michigan Comprehensive Cancer Center. And I was fortunate enough to have Dr. Pienta, who is a national expert on prostate cancer, treat me. And he, when we went through the various stages, and today it's in remission, and that's where I hope it stays.
How did you get the treatment for depression? Where did you find help?
Well, it was during this time that it became very apparent that I wasn't, it was getting worse, and I wasn't able to handle it. And that's so unusual for me. I've had a successful career. I've done many things in my life, and to have this happen to me and all of a sudden become so weak that I can't find a way out was very, very scary, frankly. And so I got referred to Dr. Reba and started care with her during my treatments, and really was a difference.
What did she do that helped you the most?
I think there's a two-pronged approach. One is the medications that for depression, which are very good today. And secondly, the psychotherapy, being able to combine the medication with the counseling that you receive. And I often say it's finding a path out. And she was so good at finding a path out for me.
Dr. Reba, when somebody gets cancer and the patient, as we mentioned, is not the only one affected, the spouse, the children, people near and dear to that person are also affected. Are they screened or offered help in a situation like this?
Well, we always say that cancer is a family illness. So I always ask the patient to try to bring a significant other in to see, first of all, if they could offer us help in the loved one who has cancer, but also in themselves, because it's a real burden often on the caretaker. And then we also ask about children or other significant members of the family, how they're doing. We want to make sure that children, too much burden isn't being put on them. We want to make sure that the family can stay intact and help one another.
How common is it that cancer patients end up with depression, for example, or some other mental health issue that they need care?
Well, it depends on the stage of cancer, the type of cancer, how old the person is, and other co-occurring medical conditions. But in general, one can think about 50% of patients during the course of their cancer care will have a diagnosable psychiatric condition. Now, that can be anxiety, depression, substance abuse, personality issues, delirium. But you can think about 50% of patients will have it. Now, what we're most interested in is the functionality and the quality of life of patients. So we want to help patients who have had a history of a psychiatric problem, treat that. We want to make sure we can prevent certain conditions and help people through their care. Many of these psychiatric issues and conditions are very, very treatable, as they were in Bill's case.
How often does a cancer treatment hospital or unit actually have psycho-oncology? Is that a fairly common thing these days, or is that still fairly rare?
I think most of the major cancer centers throughout the country have some form of a psycho-oncology program. And psychiatrists and oncologists in the community are very much aware of this, because we know that there are interactions between chemotherapy agents and treatments that psychiatrists have to be aware of, and vice versa.
Mr. Howell, you were still trying to work while dealing with cancer and anxiety. How did that work out?
Not very well. You find yourself focusing on cancer probably 90% of the time and work 10% of the time. When you first get diagnosed and you start to get this overwhelming feeling of what's going to happen to my wife. I mean, first of all, have we saved enough so she can be taken care of? What about my two sons or my grandchildren? Am I all done with them, seeing their life grow as it has in the past? And I think that when you come to understanding that there are no easy answers, That's the most scary part of it. But it becomes so overwhelming that all you're doing is researching in your mind answers to questions that have very few answers.
Dr. Reed, before a lot of people work or activities are their self-identity. I mean, what do you do when you can't function at work anymore because you're so distracted by the disease that might kill you?
I think those are some of the very difficult situations and problems that we have to negotiate with people. Years ago, you asked earlier about in the 1970s. Years ago, we used to help people stop working very early, and we've learned that helping people continue to work if that's what they choose to do and depending on the type of job they have and work they have is sometimes very therapeutic. So how to think about that and negotiate that, and some jobs are easier than others to work part-time or to have a reduced work schedule. But for many of us, work is our identity. That's who we think of when we, you know, what do you do is often a very important question. And so when that changes because of an illness or a rigorous treatment schedule is sometimes very difficult for people. In addition, the finances of having cancer are very problematic. Sometimes people have to go on disability and you know, at an early age, and they have mortgages and tuitions. And so what does that mean? Maybe the other significant other has to go back to work, and then what about the children and savings? And so
yeah, it spirals out of control after a while.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So those are important issues, and how do we help people through the survivorship is also an important aspect of this.
Bill, I want to ask you if you, you know, I don't, maybe you've met someone close to you that's been diagnosed with cancer. I mean, what do you tell them? Or if you had the opportunity to tell somebody, what would you tell them?
Well, in my situation, I was quite close. I had two brothers die of cancer, one of large cell lymphoma and one from bladder cancer. And since that time and since my treatment, I try to talk to as many people as I can about the value of the medication, about the value of the therapy and the counseling together, because one is left hand, one is right hand, and together you need them both. And I think that trying to convey this to people I run into from time to time, which has happened quite often, more often than I'd like to see, but and it's worked out very successfully.
That's Bill Halm. He is one of the patients of Dr. Reba and a cancer survivor. Michelle Reba is associate director at the University of Michigan Depression Center. Thanks for coming in and telling us about psycho-oncology.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson, who was well-behaved today. That's different. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham for Cynthia Candy. Thanks for listening.